Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, and views of our callers. Now, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls, because we have with us one of my favorite guests, and I'm sure one of your favorite guests as well, Craig Roberts. Hi, Craig. How are you doing?
Hello, Dr. Stan. How are you doing today?
Doing just great. And I understand that you've been contacted by the defense lawyers for Terry Nichols, because he's going to be tried now for the state crime of murder. And so where do you fit into this? And, of course, this is something you'd been working on actually right back there at the time of the Oklahoma City bombing, before they'd ever either convicted Terry Nichols or Timothy McVeigh. So why don't you tell the story?
Well, basically, I didn't get contacted by the lawyers yet. I received a phone call instead from Terry Nichols' brother, and James Nichols, and he wanted to know if it'd be all right to pass my number along to the lawyers defending his brother in the trial in Oklahoma. Whereas, most people already know, he's now in the process of a trial here in Oklahoma, where they've just done a jury selection. They're in the process of doing a jury selection of over 400 people to try to come up with 12 that they feel will be fair. The charge, of course, is murder, premeditated or first degree murder here, or actually it's conspiracy to commit murder, since he wasn't actually on the scene of the Murrah bombing in 1995. Of course, my conversation with Mr. Nichols was about an hour long, and I explained that I don't care if they want to contact me, that's fine. I don't know that they would want me to testify, because as one of the investigators in the bombing case, obviously my sentiments would be for the prosecution if the guy's guilty, but my main thrust is to get to the truth. I'd like the entire story to come out. I want to get to the truth, and my question was, why would you want me, as one of the investigators, as a law enforcement officer, to go to the courtroom here in Oklahoma in this and testify for the defense? Because most of the stuff I could testify for would not be anything that they could use that would defend their client. Instead, it would be more of a prosecutorial nature. And evidently, the tactics that they're going to try to use is to show that Nichols was small fish in the thing, that there were other players much more important than him involved. And I knew this. I mean, that's pretty obvious to anybody that's really investigated the case. We know that Nichols had a very small part to play in the actual technical aspect of, procuring the truck and doing all the other things that had to go along with it. But Nichols had a very important part that I'll get to in just a minute that was far above McVeigh's pay grade that I think we need the listeners to discover here today.
All right, and of course, this really gets into the fact that Terry Nichols was going over to the Philippines and was meeting with Islamic terrorists who knew how to build the bombs. Would that be a fair statement?
We'll get into that in great detail.
All right, fine. We're going to have to hold off for just a minute now, because we have to take a break at this time as we begin bringing other stations on board. So for our listeners, our guest this afternoon is Craig Roberts. Of course, he was at the time working for the police. It was in Tulsa, wasn't it?
In Tulsa, right.
Right, and he was working there, and of course, he was contacted by the FBI because he had contacts with all sorts of people that they didn't have any contact with. So he was brought in on the case really more or less on his own time, but was actually doing work with the FBI. So we'll be back in just a moment with an incredible story. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this afternoon is Craig Roberts, who at the 1995 was actually working for Tulsa Police Force. And when the bombing of the Oklahoma City building occurred, the Murrah building, on August 19th, 1995, he was asked by the FBI to come on board and give some of the information he had, because he had contacts that they did not have ready access to. So why don't you pick up the story there, Craig?
Well, basically, back in 1995, the day of the bombing, I was on my way to work and stopped at the barbershop and happened to watch it on television occur live. They just said that there had been a explosion in downtown Oklahoma City, and they showed this column of smoke coming up from a building, and they assumed at that time it was a natural gas explosion or something of that nature. Within an hour, they determined it was a bomb and that it was a car bomb. Then somebody in the bomb squad down there evidently said it was too big to be a car bomb. So by this time the FBI's arrived and they said, well, it had to be a bomb in a station wagon. Well, then they said, no, it's too big for a station wagon. So the vehicle kept getting bigger. By about 10:30 in the morning or 11 in the morning, you got to remember the explosion occurred at about 9:03. About 11 in the morning, it was now a moving van. And then somebody said that they thought they saw a Ryder truck in front and so on. And we all know what the story happened, beyond that point. That was on a Wednesday, the 19th of April. Now on Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock, my pager went off just as I was getting off work, and it was the FBI number. And I called and talked to the special agent in charge in Tulsa, and he said that they'd like to have me come in on the case. And they wanted me, basically because of my contacts and resources and so on, not only in Oklahoma but around the country, because the special agent in charge had read the Medusa file, or not the Medusa file, but Killzone, one of my books. The Medusa file wasn't out yet. He'd read Killzone, he'd read some of my other writings, and he knew that I had contacts that the FBI didn't have, couldn't buy, couldn't get. And they wanted to know whatever I could find out in Oklahoma about anybody that might have anything to do with this, including, by now they had this Timothy McVeigh in jail in Perry, Oklahoma. And they wanted to know if I could find out if he'd been any place in the state, camped out anywhere, stayed at anybody's house, ate dinner with anybody, knew anybody, and so on. In other words, develop a contact list. And so I started working on that aspect. But the problem is, when you work a case like this, you don't just chase the one trail. What happens is you run into all kinds of rabbit trails going off in other directions, and you end up investigating more than just your assigned bit. You'll run into one person, and they'll turn you on to some information that goes a different direction.
Craig, hold that thought for just a moment while another station comes up. All right, there we are. We've got our last station here. Okay, Craig is just saying that now, of course, he's been contacted by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He's been asked to come on and help them as they begin to develop a case against Timothy McVeigh. So he's asked to begin working along with the FBI. Of course, he's working for the Tulsa Police Force. And now, of course, he's working with the FBI to see what information he can come up with about Timothy McVeigh's contacts or his activities in the weeks leading up to the bombing. So you pick up the story from there, Craig.
So I started working the case. I started making contacts with a lot of different areas of interest, different individuals, everybody from people who were in militias to writers and journalists to TV reporters to people who live out in the middle of nowhere but happen to know a lot of things, that sort of thing. And it just got to the point to where this was turning into a much bigger case than one guy that was mad at the government driving a Ryder truck full of ammonium nitrate. And there's too many anomalies that were occurring. Day one in itself had so many anomalies that none of it added up to be what the government's story was coming up with. But the one thing that really caught my attention was on day one, our suspects were Middle Easterners. We had two Middle Easterner Arab-type males standing at the front door of the Murrah building wearing blue jogging suits. We had another one described as being in the truck with McVeigh when he stopped to ask directions on the way to the Murrah building with the Ryder truck, who stayed in the truck and who later was picked out photographs by the eyewitness and identified. We had others that were discovered by Jana Davis in Oklahoma City, who was working with Channel 4 at the time and was a TV reporter following up on the case. that led to an entire cell of Iraqis working for a Palestinian who happens to be a member of the PLO in Oklahoma City. And she was following up in that area when all of a sudden, right out of the blue, we're notified that there is no Middle Eastern connection out of Washington, D.C. And then the media picked it up, and the next thing we know, on Sunday, they raid James Nichols' farm up in Michigan and start going through his barn and going through his house and so on. And I'm thinking, well, you know, what does he have to do with this? By now they've tied Timothy McVeigh, who they find in the Perry jail, due to a sketch that somebody did on John Doe number one, and said, hey, I arrested a guy that looks just like that, and he's in jail in Perry. And they went and, of course, found McVeigh. And now they've tied him into Terry Nichols, who's sitting in Junction City, Kansas, at his house. And from him, they've made the leap to his brother's farm clear up in Michigan. They're searching it for traces of explosives or who knows what. And at this particular time, Washington issues a deal, and I'm talking about the Clinton White House, Janet Reno, and Louis Free, that there is no Middle Eastern connection, period, irregardless of all the facts, irregardless of the eyewitnesses, and that it's McVeigh, it's Nichols, and it's the militia. Well, I'm flabbergasted by this, because this is information that we don't have out here in the real world, out in the field. This is coming out of bureaucratic headquarters on the East Coast, and those people aren't even in the know of what's going on or up to speed. We haven't even sent reports in yet. And so I call some contacts of mine in New York City with some of the major media, because they're the ones putting the story out that they're after the militia now. And I said, where are you getting this information? I mean, this is not what we're developing here on the scene. We're chasing Iraqis, we're chasing Middle Easterners, and we had some names by then. We had APBs out, we had license numbers, we had vehicle descriptions, the whole bit. I mean, everything was panning out to be the way it should have panned out when the media spun the whole thing around and wanted everybody to go off on rabbit trails in the wrong direction. Well, we chased it back, and it came out from two sources: the Southern Poverty Law Center with Morris Dees, and the Anti-Defamation League of the B'nai B'rith, which is Abe Foxman, the same guy right now, by the way, Raising Cain with Mel Gibson in the movie The Passion, is the same one that threw the whole thing into kilter on us back in 1995 when we were trying to chase down the real bad guys in this case. So this made me start wondering, why are they protecting the guys that we know were involved? The guys who were seen at the scene, the guys who ran away and jumped in a truck and made their getaway, who took their truck to a body shop in Oklahoma City, had it painted. It was brown GMC pickup, and they had it painted yellow. Very, very poor job. That was found later by the FBI a few weeks later, abandoned in a parking lot of an apartment complex down there. I mean, the whole thing unfolded as a pretty standard crime that was not that hard to investigate until the Department of Justice at the very highest levels kept meddling in the whole thing, trying to throw the whole thing off kilter. And so it got to the point where I had FBI agents that weren't telling me the truth about certain things, that evidence was getting destroyed, that witnesses were being intimidated to change their story, and so on. And what
these are witnesses who actually seen John Doe 2 and 3 and 4, and they were told they didn't see him at all?
They were told, if you didn't see what we tell you you saw, you didn't see anything. Now, that's exactly what they said to the people in Dealey Plaza in 1963, who later were going to testify at the Warren Commission. They were told, this is what you'll testify to, and if you testify to anything else, we're not going to let you testify at all. You heard three shots, period. If you heard more than three shots, then you didn't hear any shots. I mean, this is the same kind of stuff that we had in Oklahoma City. We had two to three explosions, and people were told, you only heard one. If you heard more than that, we don't even want to hear it. They had reports that were changed. People would say, this is what I saw, this is what I heard, and by the time the report got to Washington, it was totally different. Same thing that happened in the Warren Commission in 1963. So I went back to my FBI contact, and I said, look, I just got one question. This is after about 3 months. I said, what I'm seeing here is a repeat, off-the-shelf operation of 1963, Dealey Plaza, on the JFK assassination. I said, are you guys being sent hither and yon to interview people of no significance whatsoever just to develop 302s, which is paperwork, which is FBI reports, just so that you can have a big stack of paperwork in Washington that says what a great job we did investigating this? He looked at me and he said, yes, I'm afraid so. I said, well, I can't work that route with you guys anymore, so I think what I'm going to do is just go off on my own and work with some other people that I know that I can trust, and if I come across anything really good, I'll let you know. And he kind of gave me the wink and the nod and the best of luck type deal, because the local agents were pulled out of the case, and instead they turned it over to the national FBI anti-terrorism team or task force or whatever it is that came in from out of town. They pretty much took the thing over, and it was right after that they decided that they had to destroy the Murrah building, bring it down, and take it out in the country and bury it, and then put guards on it and a fence around it. I mean, that's pretty ridiculous that you would do something like that, especially to a crime scene that you weren't even done investigating yet.
Unless, of course, you were covering up something.
And everything that we ran into was either a diversion or a cover-up on this case. Well, it was about a year and a half, 2 years later, that we started getting more information coming out of the Philippines. And it was only about a year and a half ago that we started getting paperwork to back up what we were hearing from the Philippines. And the story then unfolds, which is extremely incredible, was that in 1994, in early 1995, Terry Nichols had made several trips over to the Philippines. Now, his brother, James, disagrees with me and tells me that he was just over there chasing women and trying to buy property and trying to deal in real estate, yada, yada, yada. However, the Philippine government says different, and I had came across documents that were sent to me that showed he had gone to the Philippines on several occasions, and he had met with an organization known as Abu Sayyaf. And those that have done any recent reading at all know that Abu Sayyaf is the Islamic terrorist group in the Philippines that's trying to overthrow the government. Well, the people that he met with at Abu Sayyaf outside of Manila were a guy named Edwin Angeles, a guy named Ramsey Yosef, and a guy named Muhammad Wali Khan. Now, Ramsey Yosef, we know, later became the World Trade Center bomber.
Well, he was the one that already blown it up in 93.
In 93, he had done the bombing there, and then he went to the Philippines. He was hiding there, and he was operating an operation called Operation Bojinka. Now, Bojinka was where he was trying to build bombs to blow up 10 American jumbo jets. Now, this was to fulfill the fatwa, or the irrevocable contract, out of Iran in retribution for USS Vincennes shooting down the Iranian Airbus, back in the Persian Gulf. So because of that, the fatwa was the Iranians were going to pay something like $1 million per airplane for American jumbo jet. They wanted 10 for the price of one, and they would provide the money, they would provide the missiles, bombs, explosives, whatever it took. That was part of the deal. Well, Yosef, was going to work on this. And Yosef, by this time also, by the way, had come from Pakistan, had been trained at the old Mujahideen training camps, which are now being run by Al-Qaeda.
No, but of course, originally they were run by CIA.
They were originally run by CIA to train the Mujahideen against the Russians, but when we pulled out, the ISI, or the Pakistani version of the CIA, the Internal Security Institute, took over, and they were turned over to Al-Qaeda and to the Taliban, who were now training terrorists to operate against the United States and against European countries, and to work in Bosnia, to work in southern Russia, Chechnya, and to work in the Philippines, Saudi Arabia, Africa, Kenya, the whole bit. Now, we got Ramsey Yosef that goes there. He's trained, and he comes back, of course. Now, he's an exported terrorist to the Philippines. A lot of them were being sent to Abu Sayyaf. Now, what's interesting now is that the Philippine government had not only totally infiltrated Abu Sayyaf, they had partially set it up so they could control it. Edwin Angeles, the second in command of Abu Sayyaf, was, in fact, a Philippine government intelligence agent. That's how come we know that these meetings did occur. And the reports that were generated from him went to a senatorial investigative committee in the Senate of the Philippines through some of the senators there, and we got copies of those reports. Not only had Terry Nichols gone there, but they talked about the tall American with him, which we think may have been McVeigh. And I don't think anybody's ever said that McVeigh had gone to the Philippines, but we have information that might lead so. And when we get back from break, I want to tell you who Muhammad Wali Khan, the third member at those meetings, was.
All right, fine. Well, this is an incredible, incredible story, because it would appear that everything was done to play down the Islamic terrorist involvement in what happened in the Murrah building in 1995, what the Islamic terrorist involvement in the downing of the TWA Flight 800 then in the following year. And if you were living in Europe, the Islamists took full credit for it. Here in the United States, they tried to convince us there were no missiles. Yes, 200 people had seen the missiles, but they didn't really see what they saw. And, of course, it was an explosion in the middle fuel tank. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty.
Now, most people laugh at the idea that there is or has been a secret society. I wanted to tell you about a tape we had. It's a talk I gave before the Concerned Women of America some years ago, and it basically goes back into the background behind the secret society, which was formed in England and eventually came to America and came to be known as the Council on Foreign Relations. It goes into the background of Cecil Rhodes. And how does that secret society that he created impact on you today? If you read the works of Professor Carol Quigley, who was Bill Clinton's mentor, you'll understand that Professor Quigley is probably one of the leading experts today on history, but also a man who had the courage to speak out. You need to get the four-tape set, The Secret Government, to understand what Professor Quigley taught Bill Clinton. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is under attack today.
This is health journalist Bill Sardi. In the 1970s, there was a group of Italian immigrants in the small town of Rosetto, Pennsylvania, who drew worldwide attention for their unusual cardiovascular health, despite their pasta diets. I recently uncovered the fact that their unusual health was attributed to the precious red wine which they imported from Italy. Today we know this as the French paradox, the fact that the French exhibit greater cardiovascular health, despite their fatty diet, because of the red wine they drink. Wouldn't it be great to enjoy the health benefits of red wine without the calories, alcohol, and sulfite preservatives? Well, now you can with Longevinex, the world's first stabilized red wine molecules, preserved in an airtight capsule just like in a sealed bottle of red wine, equivalent to 5 glasses of the best red wine. Call 866-405-4000 to order Longevinex for healthy aging without the calories and alcohol. 866-405-4000.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I want to tell you about some of the items we carry, and certainly one of the items is the Big Berkey water filter, and of course it's traditional. It's been used by missionaries throughout the world for 150 years. It's stainless steel. It has ceramic filters packed with activated charcoal, which can be activated again and again, so the filters will last a very, very long time. And, of course, you put the water in the top, it comes out the bottom, and if you have fluoride in the water, you have to get special post-filters. But one of the most efficient means of getting the fluoride out of your water, the Big Berkey water filter is $239.95. If you want to see a picture of it, go to our website, radioliberty.com. But I have to tell you that the Big Berkey is available in every state in the Union except California and Iowa. But there is a different type of water filter. It's exactly the same design, except it's made of Lexan, so you can see the water level rather than, of course, the stainless steel. The filters are what we call the Black Berkey filters. There is only two of them. They're really water purifiers. They do a far better job of getting bacteria and herbicides and pesticides and fertilizers and everything out of there, the bacteria, than the other filters do. The other filters are great, but these are superb. The only trouble is they have to be replaced every 2 to 4 years. Now, this is called a Berkey Light. It's available in every state, but Iowa, it's $199.95. Of course, you can get it with fancy lights for an extra $60, but we have just a plain old Berkey Light. I think you'll like it, and if you'd like to know more about them, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. You can get the Berkey Light or the Big Berkey. They'll both take post filters and take the fluoride out. Give us a call right now at Radio Liberty. Well, our guest is Craig Roberts. He's telling us the story that, of course, that Terry Nichols had gone over to the Philippines. He was meeting with Ramzi Yousef, who was, of course, the terror bomber, Mr. Murad. And then who was the third gentleman he was meeting with?
Well, I'm actually holding one of the reports right in my hand right now. I was just reviewing this, and it said they had gone to a meeting and said that Terry Nichols was introduced with another guy to to these people in Cebu, which Cebu City, which is the home of international terrorism in the Western Pacific, and that they had a meeting with three Arabs and were escorted by Edwin Angeles to Basilan province to see the ASG leader, the Abu Sayyaf group leader. After the meeting with the ASG leader, they were taken to Zambo City, which is Zamboanga, to meet with some other people in Abu Sayyaf, including a guy named Mayor Loriente, who was directly involved with the Zamboanga del Sur. But anyway, it goes on and it says that they were going to meet and did meet with a Abdul Hakim Murad, and we've heard his name several times since 9/11 as being highly placed with. In fact, I think we've captured him recently, not only with the Al-Qaeda organization and Osama bin Laden, but also with the Iraqis, which is very interesting because we've got all this political maneuvering right now going around saying we're not sure that Iraq had anything to do with 9/11 and we can't, you know, Bush can't prove that they were a threat to us or anything else. Well, if you'll go back and just read some news articles, when the Marines first went into Iraq from Kuwait, they ran across a place called Salman Pak. And Salman Pak was a terrorist training camp, and if you remember back, it was only mentioned once in the news. They found a Boeing airliner fuselage on the ground that was used by terrorists of Al-Qaeda to practice hijacking airplanes. And then the next day, you never heard about that again. So it makes you kind of wonder how come we haven't gone back and revisited that story here lately. But getting back to this, they met not only with Abdul Hakim Murad, but with a guy named Muhammad Wali Khan. Wali is W-A-L-I, Khan K-H-A-N. And it turns out that Wali Khan was the operations officer to Abu Sayyaf, but he's also the left-hand man to none other than Osama bin Laden.
And wasn't he also the uncle of Ramzi Yousef?
Absolutely. And so you've got your tie-in right there from the Oklahoma City bombing through Nichols to the Philippines to Abu Sayyaf straight to Al-Qaeda and to Osama bin Laden. And then we have, at the same identical time, we have the U.S. government, or at least the Clinton administration, forcing us not to go in that direction, forcing us to run around the country in a wild goose chase after alleged phantom militia terrorists, which we never found anything like that or any connection whatsoever. But at the same time, we ended up letting the real culprits go on the whole deal. And then they thanked us by coming back operating later on in New York City at 9/11 and possibly some other operations against the United States around the world, including the bombing of the buildings in Saudi Arabia, the Khobar Towers.
Khobar Towers, and certainly
and USS Cole.
And Kenya and Tanzania.
Right, and the USS Cole. So had we been permitted by the Clinton bunch to chase the real wolves in this deal, we may have been able to prevent all, if at least not some of what we just talked about.
Well, I think it's an incredible story when you see this cover-up over and over again. I believe it was the same thing the following year in 1996. The last thing they wanted us to know was, of course, that there were Islamic terrorists, and some of them were working right here in the United States. And that's what's so significant about that film that Stephen Emerson put out that had actually pictures of the leader of Al-Qaeda in 1988 in Oklahoma City, talking about a revolution, talking about jihad in America, and that was covered up by our intelligence agencies. They wouldn't allow it to be shown. It was shown one time in 1994 on PBS and then suppressed after that. And you have to ask, why? Why were they trying to keep the American people from knowing about this terrorist threat until September 11th?
Well, what's interesting is we had three different things that kind of follow the same method of operation. You've got the drug war, which never was a war against drugs, not only just the Clintons, but the first Bush was in power. It goes back, you know, before Iran-Contra, but we can really just look at Iran-Contra and see that all the cocaine smuggling coming out of South America into this country was coming in through channels operated by current or former CIA members. That whole thing was covered up, and when we tried to do drug interdictions all across the Gulf and the Caribbean, none of those things ever really occurred except in small scale, and then only against the competitors. So you have the same thing. It's over and over where they have, they tell you this is what we need to do, this is what we need to spend money on, but it doesn't get done.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a couple of minutes with Craig Roberts and tell you more of this incredible story.
Have you ever wondered what really happened at Waco? Have you ever wondered if maybe the government was not giving you the full story? Well, there is the most amazing video. It's called Waco, the Rules of Engagement, 2.5 ripping hours of the story of a government onslaught into a group of peaceable people. Now, their religion may be different than yours and mine, but they were still Christians, they still believed in the Bible, and they believed that the government would one day become their enemy and destroy them. Well, Waco, the Rules of Engagement is a video that everybody who loves freedom should see, because the ultimate conclusion is the government did not want them to come out. The government did everything they could to keep them from coming out, to antagonize them, loud music, lights all the time, to totally create a situation where they could not think clearly or respond normally. Waco, the Rules of Engagement, is currently unavailable through regular sources. Call 1-800-5-HIB-WAR right now.
This is Dr. Stan. Let me tell you about a few of the other things that we have. Certainly one of them is Phonopoly. And Phonopoly is a wonderful game. It's designed to teach you or your children, your grandchildren, how to read and spell and pronounce words phonetically. And, of course, it's a board game played like Monopoly. It's really five board games and two bonus games. In about 16 hours, you can undo all of the harm that's been done by the government schools in dumbing down the children of this state, the children of this country. You could not do as bad a job in teaching reading and mathematics in this country unintentionally. They've known exactly what they were doing. Well, Phonopoly gives your children a fighting chance. Most of these programs that teach phonics, $300, $400, $500, $800. This one's $139.95. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Ask about Phonopoly, and we give you a couple of books right along with the Phonopoly set. And then, of course, we also carry Miracle 2 soap products, and we can't make any medical claims for them, but I will tell you that lots of people who use these products really like them, and they tell us all sorts of wonderful stories. They would be without them, whether it's the moisturizing soap or the regular soap, that they've used to prevent rashes, whether it's the gel that some people use for acne. All we can do is tell you the people who use these products love them, and a lot of people tell us it helps the upper gastrointestinal tract, and that's the neutralizer. Other people tell us it helps the lower intestinal tract, and, well, we have, of course, a lot of regular users. We hope that you'd want to be one, too. You go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. You can actually see pictures of the products. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 if you're interested in an introductory offer to Miracle 2 products. Well, Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this afternoon is Craig Robertson. We're talking about the Oklahoma City bomber. We're talking about Terry Nichols and the fact that Terry Nichols was going over to the Philippines and meeting with representatives of this radical Islamic movement, radical Iraqi movement, and, of course, radical Islamic movement with direct ties to Al-Qaeda, and the government knows that. The one thing is they're not going to allow this information to be brought out of the Terry Nichols trial or at the Timothy McVeigh trial. And if you've read the books by Stephen Jones, he will tell you he was not allowed to bring any of this information out. Why? Why? Because they didn't want the American people to know about the radical Islamic movement. Would that be a fair statement, Craig?
I think that's true. And the point we were going to make before we went on break was that we see the same thing with the war on drugs. We see the same thing with the non-stop immigration invasion out of Mexico, where we don't have anybody guarding the southern border anymore. We're told that they're doing all this work and they're making all these laws and they're diligently working to shut off the southern border, and nothing happens. We're told that they're fighting terrorism, but somehow or another, a lot of this stuff just doesn't get done. We're told that they're interdicting drugs, but the drugs don't get interdicted. I think it goes back to what we've talked about many times in the past, and that's a Hegelian effect. If you can't pass these laws, you can't create these solutions to problems that you want to shove on the American people unless you have problems that create fear. Now, if we can, it's the old have the problem, come up with a solution, and we have to accept it because it's better than no solution at all. So if we have... The Oklahoma City bombing, we have to have laws that will make sure that that doesn't happen again. So we have the Omnibus Crime Control Act of 1995 and 1996 passed, which is you know, several hundred pages that really takes a lot of the Constitution away. That wasn't enough, so along comes other things that occur afterwards, including TWA 800. You know, they say it was a center fuel tank explosion, and then they turn around and they increase the airport security and blame it on TWA 800 because the militias obviously blew up the airplane. This is what they left in the minds of the American people, even though they wouldn't admit that it was a missile that took the airplane down, and of course no militia has any missiles, so who would it have been? Then we have the war on drugs. We've got to have more drug agents, we've got to have more money, we've got to have more assets to stop the flow of drugs. But yet, right in the middle of when the Clinton administration was supposedly ramping up the war on drugs, I happened to be in Gulfport, Mississippi, with an Air Force unit I was assigned to, and right next to us was the U.S. Customs and DEA people with their aircraft, their jets and their Black Hawk helicopters, and all the airplanes were sitting on the ground, and I walked over and talked to them for a little while, and I said, when are you guys going to fly again? And they said, we're not flying. And I said, why not? And he says, because the Clintons, so they shut us down. They took our budget away from us and shut down all air interdiction over the Gulf. And later on, I actually saw that in the news, in the mainstream media. There was one mention of it, and then we didn't hear about it again. And instead, we had Barry McCaffrey, who was the general in charge of Southcom, retires and becomes the Clinton drug czar. And you'd think the guy that was stationed at MacDill Air Force Base in Florida, in charge of all Special Operations Command, would know how to interdict drugs. And yet, when he gets up there, we see the drugs actually increase, and all interdiction efforts stop. So, but then we have more laws that are passed. Then 9/11 comes along, even though it's a change of administration. What happens? We get the Patriot Act. And the Patriot Act pretty much destroys what's left of the Constitution. A lot of it is basically just writing. It's just pages, ink on paper, but it can be implemented at the drop of a hat, and it can be abused at the drop of a hat by anybody that wants to. These model health acts that came out right afterwards that ran around to all of the states, that if you don't want to come in and get your shots and you don't want to register for vaccinations, we'll come and take your guns away. Well, now, excuse me, but what does having vaccinations have to do with the Second Amendment? You know, what's wrong with this picture here? So it just goes and goes and goes. There's never any end to it. It's a constant flood of this stuff, and the television sits there every night, shows us all of these terrible things that are happening, and then they go straight to the politicians and they demand, what are you going to do about it? And the politicians say, we're coming up with more laws and we're going to stop this because we're going to write laws. Well, folks, that's not the way it works. The way things get stopped is they get stopped where they happen, not in Washington, D.C. Writing all the laws in the world will not stop something. Criminals don't care about the laws. If they cared about laws, they wouldn't be called outlaws. So therefore, what we've got is a situation where we have to deal with these things locally. If we see somebody in our neighborhood that doesn't fit, we're going to have to do something about that. We'll get the local police to work on the deal. We don't call the FBI. We don't call our senator. We don't call our congressman. If we did it on the local level, it wouldn't pass off and get in the hands of people who are clueless on how to deal with it to begin with and use every opportunity and every excuse to progress their private agendas and pass the laws that they want to pass no matter what. We've got one going through, that was initiated last year, I don't know if it's gone anywhere, that has to do something with something the Sniper Act that Schumer and Feinstein and all that crew initiated. Now, back when we were working on the Oklahoma City bombing, there were several gun laws that were going through, and one of them dealt with sniper weapons, or sniper class weapons. And when you read it, you found out what they were really talking about with deer rifles. They wanted to eliminate high-powered deer rifles or hunting rifles because they wanted to say if it's got a scope on it, it's a sniper weapon. Well, having been a real Marine Corps sniper in Vietnam, I can tell you there's a big difference between a deer rifle and a real sniper rifle, but the Schumer and Feinstein and Lautenberg and all of that crew, it was just another weapon class that they could get rid of by demonizing it. You talk about assault weapons. I testified in Congress 10 days before the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995 against Brady II and the extended magazine ban and all that sort of nonsense that California jumped all over. I was flown to Washington with six other police officers, and we testified against that in the Subcommittee on Crime. And Schumer's deal was the assault rifle was the weapon of choice of drug lords. Well, folks, the weapon of choice of drug lords is a cell phone. What they do is they call somebody to do the dirty work for them, and the weapon of choice of drug dealers is a pocket pistol. It's not an Ingram, it's not an assault rifle, it's not an Uzi, but the Washington politicians would make us think this. And so what they're really doing by attacking the Second Amendment is reducing the firepower of the people out here in flyover land, so that there's no chance against us or of us having the ability to protect ourselves against anything, much less criminals, against overbearing politicians, against anything else. The Second Amendment was designed for us to be able to do that, but by reducing our firepower, by outlawing certain types of weapons or certain classes of weapons, they've done away with the Second Amendment. Next, we have to do away with the First Amendment. How do we do that? Well, we don't attack freedom of the press, because the press is totally controlled already. What we do instead is we attack freedom of religion, which is, now we get into the debate of the church versus the state and so on that we hear so much of. And there is no such thing as separation of church and state, and I'm sure that you've pounded that one into the ground, Doc. But it just gets under my ire every time we see it, and we see what happens today. When they take the Ten Commandments out of the rotunda of the courthouse in Alabama, and it's just a few months later, we have the mayor of San Francisco issuing marriage licenses for homosexual marriages. Where is the balance here? It's okay to hurt the self-esteem of a Christian. It's okay to slap a Christian in the face. It's okay to hurt the feelings of a Christian, but you can't hurt the feelings of one of these other protected groups. So where's the equality here? So, you know, what's good for the goose isn't necessarily good for the gander in the world of socialism, communism, and liberalism.
Well, when you understand there's an attack against God, and that the attack really, everything is totally illogical, then everything makes sense. But this is really a war against God, and it's really at that point we begin to understand why these activist judges have had to get God and prayer and the Ten Commandments out of our schools. But let's get back to Terry Nichols over there, because this is really so important. The involvement, of course, of Terry Nichols, and certainly secondarily Tim McVeigh, with these Iraqi terrorists, and of course with the Islamic terrorists over there in the Philippines, that information has been totally suppressed from the American people. Why is that, you think?
Well, if we go there, then we're going to find out how these Iraqis that were in this cell got over here. You've got 10 to 12 Iraqis. We have all of their names. We've got pictures of them. We know who paid for them. We know where they came from. Reports have been written on this stuff. The government has every bit of this information, but they won't react to it. We know that they work for a PLO guy who was involved in the real estate business in Oklahoma City. I won't go into a lot of details because I don't want to ruin any further investigation where we might be able to actually get this guy. But they worked for him, and what they would do is they would fix up these old HUD homes, and then there would be a mysterious fire, the house would burn down, and they would claim the insurance money for more than it's worth, and then the money would be taken over to Jerusalem and given to the PLO. It was just another means of funding. And, of course, it happens to be in the same city where they had the biggest Hamas meeting in 10 years, which is Oklahoma City. The biggest Hezbollah group met there at one time. So, we know that the cells are there. So these guys that we know about in this particular cell were Iraqis. Well, how did they get here and where did they come from? Well, as it turns out, they were POWs that we had captured outside of Basra back during the Gulf War. These were the guys that blew up all the oil wells in Kuwait. And we brought not just them, but we brought 3,500 of them that we know of over here. And some estimates go as high as 5,000 eventually being brought over here who had fought for Saddam Hussein. Now, this is the same government that brought these guys over here who left our own POWs behind in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. And even though now we found out about the Scott Spiker case in the Gulf War. Just wrote them off, I guess, and left them behind. And yet we use taxpayers' money to bring them over here through Carlisle Barracks, Pennsylvania, and then scattered them all over the country in 10- and 12-man cells as a humanitarian effort, of course. Well, what we did is we imported 3,500 terrorists who were pro-Saddam, anti-American, and started preaching that stuff. They immediately joined Hamas. They immediately joined Islamic Jihad and Hezbollah and some of the other groups, and formed more cells. So we ended up with a cell in Oklahoma City. John Doe, number two, the guy that was spotted in the truck with McVeigh, was one of these Iraqi terrorists. He was identified by an American citizen working in a tire store when the truck stopped, McVeigh got out, asked him for directions to the Murrah building, almost as if he wanted to be seen. And the guy looked at McVeigh and told him, and he looked at the guy who was sitting in the right-hand side of the truck. We then later find out there's another eyewitness that spot the same guy when the truck stops one block short of the Murrah building to wait for a parking place in front of the Murrah building. Because there was a UPS truck at the front door at 9 o'clock, the two Iraqis wearing the blue jogging suits who were at the front door, that later was in the newspaper, as soon as the UPS truck left, they ran out and held a parking place so McVeigh could move the Ryder truck, which is parked across the street from the post office, against the curb a block to the west, to move it back or move it up to the front door and position the truck. We also know that there was a man across the street in the parking lot of the post office who saw McVeigh get out of the truck and talk to another Middle Eastern man who's shorter, that had black curly hair, on the curb behind the truck while John Doe 2 was still sitting up in the cab. Later we find out there may have been a female in the truck with McVeigh. Now, this is the first you've heard of this, because this is something we just found out, that other witnesses said they saw a female get out of the truck along with John Doe 1, which is McVeigh, and John Doe 2, which was our Iraqi. So now we've got a third thing in the mix here that what we didn't know before. We go back and we look at the book, American Terrorist, that allegedly McVeigh gave all the information to these two guys up in Buffalo, New York, who were newspaper reporters, to write. That said, this is what I did. I did it by myself. This is how I did it. Well, I went through that book page by page, and it is so full of garbage and lies, it's ridiculous. The thing is total fiction. Where McVeigh said that as he was pulling up in front of the building, he lit two fuses from the cab of the truck with, I guess, a Bic lighter or something, and the fuses were burning, and he was going to, you know, he knew about how long it would take for these fuses to burn, and he drove up in front of the building, parked the truck, and got out with burning fuses.
One was a 5-minute fuse, one was a 1-minute fuse.
It was totally ludicrous.
I mean, it was really, who would be driving a truck, you know, full of explosives and light the 5-minute fuse 5 minutes out and the 1-minute fuse 1 minute out if you didn't know there was going to be a parking place there?
Well, that's just it. And the other thing is, when Nichols was in the Philippines, the information we got was that they were teaching him how to build bombs. Now the Arabs don't use what we call mechanical fuses, fuses that you light. They use very sophisticated electronic fuses. They use electric blasting caps with batteries and timers and the whole bit. It's not that hard to do. Anybody can learn how to do it. It's not a huge effort deal. And McVeigh was plenty smart enough to know from his military training how to do a timer on it, or how to do a remote detonator with a push button. So that was all hokum, and we knew that going in up front.
And let me just ask you one quick question before we're running out of time. If you read Stephen Jones' book, Others Unknown, Oklahoma City Bombing Conspiracy, he claims that Timothy McVeigh wrote a letter to his sister Jennifer saying, "I'm working with a secret special forces unit involved in illegal activity." Now, Jones tried to bring that out at the trial. In fact, he did bring it out at the trial, totally ignored by the media. Where does this fit into the whole picture?
Well, there's a lot in that whole area that bears a close scrutiny, because, you know, McVeigh, one of my first assignments was track McVeigh, find out where he's been. Well, I went to the Army, and Fort Riley said he was AWOL, but then later when I called back, they said, well, he's not AWOL. He went to Fort Bragg to go to Special Forces School. So I get hold of Fort Bragg, and depending on what day of the week you call him, you get a different answer as to who's Timothy McVeigh and what happened to him and where did he go. He goes up there, and then he disappears. And I think he got sheep-dipped, because the next thing I know, the next thing we find out, he's working for Calspan Incorporated in Buffalo, New York, as a security guard. Now, how can he work for a government contractor who uses secret and top-secret clearances for its employees if he's AWOL from the Army?
There's something really wrong with this whole story. You don't think that possibly he really was, of course, still working for a secret government unit?
To tell you the truth, Doc, I think that those units exist, and I think it's highly possible that he was working for something like that, because you had a guy just like Lee Harvey Oswald, who was All-American hero, Bronze Star winner, gung-ho, one minute, and then he disappears, and a year later he's an anti-government zealot. One speaks Russian and the other goes to militia meetings and passes out Turner diaries. or is that Fair Play for Cuba committee pamphlets? It's one of those things. It just, you know, it's the same thing over and over. If you look at Oswald and you look at Timothy McVeigh, you find two profiles almost identical from the time they were born until the time they allegedly died.
You mean you're talking about Lee Harvey McVeigh. And, of course, McVeigh did everything he could to identify himself with the militia. I mean, he's just blown up a building and killed 168 people. He's wearing a militia, you know, a T-shirt. He has all this material about identifying himself with the militia, including a copy of the Turner Diaries there, almost like it was all scripted ahead of time. Our guest has been Craig Roberts, and if you haven't read his book, The Medusa File, you really need to. We'll tell you about that when we get back. Anything else you wanted to say, Craig, before we let you go?
Just give my website, riflewarrior.com, and they can see what else I've written.
Well, go there, riflewarrior.com. Craig's one of my favorite guests. God bless you. We'll talk to you later.
See you later, Doc. Bye-bye.
Have you ever wondered what really happened at Waco? Have you ever wondered if maybe the government was not giving you the full story? Well, that is the most amazing video. It's called Waco, the Rules of Engagement, 2.5 ripping hours of the story of a government onslaught into a group of peaceable people. Now, their religion may be different than yours and mine, but they were still Christians, they still believed in the Bible, and they believed that the government would one day become their enemy and destroy them. Well, Waco, the Rules of Engagement is a video that everybody who loves freedom should see, because the ultimate conclusion is the government did not want them to come out. The government did everything they could to keep them from coming out, to antagonize them, loud music, lights all the time, to totally create a situation where they could not think clearly or respond normally. Waco, the Rules of Engagement is currently unavailable through regular sources. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR right now.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and let me just mention some of the items we have. We have a wonderful four-tape set on the Oklahoma City bombing. We have an update on the Oklahoma City bombing. And you really need to understand that we've never gotten the truth about what really happened in Oklahoma. We actually have two videos on them. One of it is called Cover Up in Oklahoma City. And if you watch this, you'll actually see the interviews of the people who were in the building and what happened, why the building began to shake, and they jumped under the desk, and then came the explosion from outside. It's a fascinating video, and of course you'll actually see them film footage. It was shot in Oklahoma City on the day of the bombing, as they talk about finding the second bomb unexploded and the third bomb unexploded. But of course this was never shown across America. Why? Because you were never supposed to know that there were lots of other bombs in the building, and of course there was a bomb outside and there was bombs inside that building. So let me suggest the Cover Up in Oklahoma City, and actually the 2-4 tape set on Oklahoma City, and then of course we actually have the Oklahoma City special, which is 2 videos, 2-4 tape sets, because this is key to understanding what happened on September 11th. There was an Islamic terrorist involvement in this, and the government covered it up, exactly as they covered up the Islamic terrorist involvement in the downing of TW-800. And we've got 4 tape sets on that. And we've got a wonderful video called Silenced, and you'll actually see interviews with the people who saw the missiles going up. You will see the testimony that was given before the Aviation Administration meetings, where they tell you what happened, and they quote the witnesses, and then you'll actually see the interviews with the witnesses. Call 1-800-544-8927 and order these items right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when we need to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you, if you're out there, will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours a day, 4 hours a day on shortwave, and 5 hours a day on the Internet, and about 60 stations across America that pull down some of our programming every week. But it's an expensive proposition, quite frankly. We need your help. If you believe that we're involved in a battle for the survival of America, that there's a spiritual component to this, We hope many of you will give serious consideration to calling us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And then we mentioned a moment or two ago that we have a four-tape set on Oklahoma City. We have a four-tape set on Oklahoma City Update. We have a video on cover-up in Oklahoma City. In fact, we have a two videos and two four-tape sets. We call it the Oklahoma City Special. And actually, you get, $80 or $90 worth of products, and I think we charge you $69.95. We pay the postage for it. And if you would like a free copy of my August of the year 2002 newsletter entitled The Oklahoma City Bombing, where we, of course, go into a great deal of information that Craig Roberts has given us, that's August of 2002. We'd be glad to send that free of charge. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Or if you'd like to get a copy of our latest newsletter free of charge, we'll send it to you. Of course, I don't want most people to know this, but we really hope that you'll want to subscribe to the newsletter after reading it, because you're going to learn things there that you're just not going to get from other sources. Of course, you can always go up on our website at RadioLiberty.com and pull down our newsletters for nothing, and you have our permission to copy them. We'd appreciate if you'd subscribe, but if you can't afford it, go up on the website, pull down the newsletters, and get them duplicated. Encourage others to go to our website. Of course, if you look up there, you'll find out the products we offer. And, of course, we offer the Big Berkey products. If you buy them from us, you get a four-tape set or a video we produced. If you get, of course, a Big Berkey or Berkey Light. But we hope that you'll look at our website and become a regular visitor there, listening to our archives, listening to our live programs, and encouraging other people to get informed. Because, believe me, our audience is increasing because good people are telling other people about what's going on and letting them understand that they're not getting the truth from Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, Dan Rather, or Tom Brokaw, or CBS, or NBC, or ABC, or CNN. Because, of course, they are all paid very large sums of money not to reveal but to conceal the truth from the American people. In fact, Donald Rumsfeld owns a ranch with Dan Rather. I bet you didn't know that. The two birds of a feather, they flock together. And you won't hear Don saying anything bad about his partner, Donald Rumsfeld. Well, anyway, there's so much information that we have available through Radio Liberty. If you call us, we'll send you free of charge a catalog. And then, of course, we hope that many of you will want to get the video, Diaprax in the Church, the story of the church growth movement, Megiddo, the story of what's going on geopolitically now, and how we got into World War III, and we are in World War III, whether you know it or not. My video, Brotherhood of Darkness, and my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. My video, Iraq, the Untold Story, going into all the wars of the last century. Every single one of them was contrived. There was no Bay of Tonkin incident. They knew the attack was coming on Pearl Harbor. And, of course, those boys fought and bled and suffered and died, not for the reasons they were told, but in pursuit of a new world order and a new world religion. Well, we do hope that many of you out there will pray for America, that you'll pray for our leaders, that you pray for revival, because I'm firmly convinced that if America doesn't turn back to God, why, we're going to lose this country. And lastly, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow, when we'll be with you again, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.